Popcorn Poops is brought to you by Audible.com. Please visit audibletrial.com/popcornpoops for a free audiobook and free 30-day trial of their subscription service. Audible is the internet's leading provider of audiobooks with more than 150,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature, including fiction, nonfiction, and periodicals. Audible.com is offering a free audiobook download to listeners of Popcorn Poops along with a 30-day trial of their services. This week we're recommending Dark Directions, Romero, Craven, Carpenter, and the Modern Horror Film by Kendall R. Phillips, narrated by Scotty Drake. To download this or another audiobook of your choice, visit audibletrial.com/popcornpoops. Be sure to visit the correct URL so they know we sent you, and you'll be helping to support our show. Again, that's audibletrial.com/popcornpoops for your free audiobook.
We are the Popcorn Poops.
Hey everyone, and welcome to Popcorn Poops, the best married couple movie podcast / commentary track hybrid audio program on the internet. My name is Jessica.
And I'm Dustin.
This month our theme is bad horror movies, and my pick for this week's episode is Ethan Wiley's 1987 film, House 2, The Second Story. If you are syncing this recording up to the movie, go ahead and start the film and then press pause as soon as the title card reading New World Pictures Presents completely fades to black.
It's time to start the movie. Syncers, press play at the beep after the countdown. Ready? 3, 2, 1. And we're off. I want to clarify the syncing at the beginning. We do, in fact, mean the title card reading New World Pictures Presents and not the vanity card because of reasons. So make sure it's the title card that says New World Pictures Presents and not the one with the New World Pictures logo. So, yeah, House 2, The Second Story. This is your pick for this week. And I'm going to let you explain why you picked this movie, because I have a bone to pick with you about it.
So, oh, yeah?
Yeah, go ahead.
Hmm. I love this series. This is one of my favorite bad horror movie series, the House movies. The third one isn't really a house movie.
It's not. I was going to mention that. The third one is called, was rebranded as House 3, but it was actually originally a movie called The Horror Show, which was just a ripoff of Wes Craven's Shocker.
Right.
Which wasn't a very good movie to begin with. So
for ripping off.
Yeah.
Yeah, House 3 excluded because it's not really, it doesn't feel like a house movie at all. This is a great bad horror movie series. The first one is actually not that bad of a bad movie, I think, which is why I didn't pick it. Mm-hmm. I mean, It's still pretty bad, but
it's not like laughably bad.
Yeah.
It's just like, oh, this kind of doesn't work.
Yeah. And I love the first house anyways. The fourth house is a childhood thing for me. The fourth house, there's a scene in it where a pizza comes to life and starts talking, and then someone stuffs it down like a garbage disposal.
Yes.
And that image stayed with me. My parents must have rented it and watched it when I was a kid, because that image stayed with me up until a couple years ago, when finally I was just like, I have to find this movie, whatever this movie was, and finally figured it out and tracked it down and watched it, and it's horrible. But anyways, though, the second one in this series is my favorite, which is why I've picked this one.
Okay. Now, the bone I have to pick with you about this is that I think that this movie is neither a horror movie nor an actually bad movie. Now, my argument there is that it is very, very clearly a comedy to me.
It's a horror comedy.
Okay. But it's mostly a comedy. There's nothing in this movie that I think was even trying to be genuinely frightening. Nothing at all, really. Except for maybe this opening sequence, which is kind of, you know, standard horror movie, haunted house kind of, you know, sneaking through the house with a gun and there's, you know, someone in the house and whatever, that kind of thing. But this movie is definitely a comedy first and a horror movie second. And second of all, I don't think it's really a bad movie, because I think that this movie's goals are very clear in being a comedy horror, and I think that it actually meets those goals pretty well.
And I agree with that, actually, but I also agree, or also disagree with you on believing that, to me, a movie like Slugs did everything it was supposed to do as well. So
no, it did not. Come on.
It absolutely did.
No, it met your requirements, not its own. That's different.
Okay, I get what you're saying. Yes, this movie was very self-aware, I think.
Yes.
As opposed to like Slugs or something, right? Absolutely. So Slugs was not self-aware. They really were trying to make a good movie, and they failed at making a good movie.
Right. Same with Sleepaway Camp.
So
which
for
we did
me,
last week.
That succeeded in being that meant that it succeeded in being the movie that I wanted it to be. But this movie, I don't think it was ever trying to be a good movie. I think that it knew from the beginning that it was the sequel to a movie that was already kind of, you know, like House One actually made money in the box office. Like it actually did pretty well for itself. I think it only had like a $3 million budget or something, and it grossed like $19 million or something. So in the end, it was actually kind of successful, but people still regarded it as a pretty bad movie.
Right.
And they knew that going into making this movie, and I think they were just like, fuck it.
Okay.
Right? And I mean, they just made a ridiculous movie.
This movie does have a level of fuck it to it. It is very self-aware, I think. And I think that that's rare for that to work. And going into this month, I didn't expect to, nor did I really want to do movies that were intentionally quote unquote bad movies, because I don't think that works too often. I think the snakes on a plane bullshit, the Sci-Fi Channel original movie, the Sharknado garbage, is just garbage that knows it's garbage and it wants to be garbage, so it tries to be as bad as possible, and that never ever works. It's never genuine. I think it works in this movie because I think that there's good comedy writing in this. So I think it works as a horror comedy. I don't think it works as a so bad it's good because we're trying to do that.
Critics would disagree with you.
Yeah.
They would say that the stuff I've read about this movie, everyone says that the comedy doesn't work in this movie, that it's not funny, it falls flat.
There's some line deliveries
in this that
make me laugh.
I think it's pretty funny. It has, now there are only like a handful of reviews, but it has a 0% on Rotten Tomatoes.
There's only like 9 reviews though. That barely counts.
But still, people genuinely see this as a bad movie. I don't agree with that. I agree with what you're saying, which is that I think this movie knew what it was doing, and I think that it succeeded at making a bad movie, which rarely happens when you set out to make a bad movie.
I don't know.
I did cheat, and so what?
It's kind of, you know, half and half. I don't know. I think it's like half and half self-aware bad movie that kind of succeeds at that, and half
but
comedy.
I think it falls flat in a lot of ways, too. So,
sure.
So it does. I think it meant to be maybe a little better than it actually turned
out.
It's
no Shaun of the Dead or anything.
No,
like that.
Absolutely
not. Even
not
close. But no. But it's fun. It's a fun watch, and I do enjoy this movie. So let's jump back to the beginning. I have some things that I wanted to say. One of the first credits you should notice is a Sean S. Cunningham production. Do you know who Sean S. Cunningham is?
Absolutely not.
I'm sorry. That tickled me. Sean, that was good. Good delivery. Sean S. Cunningham is a writer, producer, director who is most famous for creating the Friday the 13th series. He wrote and directed and produced the very first Friday the 13th movie, which we talked a bit about last week during our Sleepaway Camp episode, because it is famously a ripoff of that franchise.
Right.
But yeah, I thought the opening credits were kind of cool. The skull that is central to this movie,
the Indiana Jones and the Crystal Skull.
Yeah.
This was a prequel, if you didn't know.
The MacGuffin, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
The skull is the MacGuffin in this movie. It's what all the characters want and are chasing constantly, and it moves the plot forward constantly. But the way the skull is used in that opening credit sequence really reminded me of John Carpenter's Halloween.
Yes, absolutely.
And the jack-o'-lantern, the famous, you know, jack-o'-lantern shot in those opening credits. I think it was very obviously, referencing that. But yeah, the director, Ethan Wiley, not really anyone of note, I don't think. He wrote the first House film. He just wrote that one. And he wrote this one and directed this one. And his other directorial credits include such great works as Children of the Corn 5, oh. Fields of Terror.
Okay.
And Elf Man.
Oh, we got to find that. That's a horror, right?
I assume Elf Man stars...
It's not like a Christmas special or something.
Orlando right? Bloom.
Oh, you can just back up.
And my bum.
No, don't start
sorry,
it.
I'm sorry. So yeah, we at the in the opening of the movie, we get the couple. There's a couple in the house that gives their baby away to another couple who drives away. They go back in the house with a shotgun and they run into this creature, this specter, this ghostly creature that's like a kind of looks like a cowboy because he is a fucking cowboy. And when they try to shoot him, he shoots them dead first. And then we get a little stamp that says 25 years later, and we get our main characters, ostensible main characters, Jesse and Kate. Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Jesse and Kate coming back to this house, and Jesse says something that leads the audience to believe that the parents at the beginning, or the people at the beginning of the movie, were his parents and he was the baby. They were killed and he's coming back to, I guess, claim his house.
Yeah, he sees a picture and he just like spews all of it out. He's like, hey, that's my mom and dad.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
Look, that's me.
That's me as a baby. Yeah, he as he's looking through that photo album, I'm like, who are you talking to there, buddy?
Look, that's my great grandfather. They named me after him.
His girlfriend Kate is on the phone with her boss. She works for a record label, which comes back up later. And yeah, I don't know. Like it reminded me. We talked about this a bit last month when we did our anime month, but it reminds me of why the internal monologue doesn't work in anime. It doesn't really work here either. Like, you make it internal or external. When someone talks to themselves, they better be broken upstairs. Or it just doesn't come off the right way, right? Because
it's really delicate. It has to have someone talking to themselves.
It is a fine line. For
yes,
sure.
It is. And I mean, not that there aren't moments in the real world, in my real life, where I say something out loud and know that there is absolutely no one around.
We got a little bit of THO action, courtesy of Amy Yazbek.
Thank you.
Do you know what a THO is?
No.
It's a titty hard-on.
What?
A titty hard-on.
Oh, her nipples are hard?
Yes. Amy Yazbek. She was my first live action redhead crush. First what? Ever in
Who?
My life.
Is that this girl?
No, Who's? Amy, the redhead. Amy Yazbek, her.
Yeah?
Yes.
Her? That's what I was saying. That's.
Yes, she was my first live action. Live, that's important. Live action.
Oh, dear.
My first 3D redhead crush.
From what? Not from this?
No, from The Mask. She's in The Mask. She plays Peggy Brandt, I think her character's name is, in The Mask with Jim Carrey.
She's in The Mask. That's weird because I told you, I'm stupid.
Did I?
Was your response.
I say that a lot. So.
But your response was, I'm stupid. But I feel like the guy in this movie, what's his name? Jack? No?
Charlie.
Charlie?
Yeah.
Whatever. One of those obvious names.
Jack, Charlie,
Jack,
Kim,
Charlie,
Mike,
Bob, Timmy, Tom, Michael. Charlie here, this guy. I thought he kind of was doing like an almost Jim Carrey thing, like a later Jim Carrey thing. You said no.
No, I didn't. I don't get that. I think he's definitely playing an archetype, which is the.
I think he kind of looks like him too.
He's the tall and lanky, goofy comic relief in an 80s movie, and you know that archetype still kind of exists, and I think that's. Actually, Jim Carrey played that role a little bit in the 80s, but he wasn't really a thing yet.
Well, I know that, but
I don't think that Jim Carrey was enough of a thing for you to say that this guy was like.
No, I don't think so. I just think that he reminded me. I know Jim Carrey's first leading role was in 1985.
Yes,
Once Bitten, and he didn't really blow up until like the 90s, right?
No, it wasn't until the year that he did what was it, Dumb and Dumber, and. Oh, what was it? It was like Dumb and Dumber, The Mask, and Ace Ventura, all within like a 2-year period or something like that.
But this guy just reminds me of him. I don't know, of it's in his face, the way he looks, the way he kind of talks, some of the expressions he makes.
I guess I can kind of see it.
But so that's why I'm saying it's strange that you're talking about her being in the mask.
Yeah. So do you know what my first actual redhead crush was?
Who?
My first not 3D.
Go ahead. Just embarrass yourself.
Ariel,
publicly.
Of course, from The Little Mermaid.
Are you being serious?
Yes.
That's really cute.
I loved her when I was little.
I thought
little.
You were going to say some...
I was so in love with her when I was a kid.
Weird anime thing.
What?
Some
no.
skanky like...
No.
But I guess you didn't get into that till you were older.
Yeah, yeah. No. When I was a little kid, I was in love with Ariel.
That's really cute.
I wanted to marry her.
That's adorable.
We've got some actors in this movie.
Why are you laughing while you say
I'm sorry,
that?
I'm sorry. We've got thespians. We have some thespians in this film. Our main character, Jesse, is played by an actor by the name of Arya Gross. And he's known mostly as a TV actor, as I understand it, with a few film parts here and there. And then we've got Kate, his girlfriend, played by Lar Park Lincoln. This kind of was a little funny to me. She has 21 credits on IMDb. Mm-hmm. 21. And they're mostly random single episodes of a bunch of different TV shows and one recurring role on a soap opera. And with that, she wrote a book about success in Hollywood. About how to achieve quick success in Hollywood. So I guess that's enough.
Yeah, well.
With all due respect to Miss or Mrs. Park Lincoln, is that enough?
Well, it's kind of like when I'm on Twitter and I'm seeing indie authors post things about their blogs about the 5 best tips to getting on a New York bestsellers list. And I'm like, what? What are you talking about, man? Don't you kind of got to do that before
you got to do it first before you write about how to do it. Yes.
But, you know, whatever.
Right.
To each his own.
The scene right before this, when they're looking through the photo album or the book or all the old newspaper clippings and stuff, we've got that him talking to himself again. It's like a disease or something, right? It is a disease that causes you to talk to yourself while looking through photographs, I think. But, I mean, in reality, it is talking to yourself, but actually talking to the audience.
Right.
And that's the problem.
That is the problem.
That's the issue that I have with it.
Well, that's the thing, is, and I think that's where the line is drawn, is because when I'm reading something or I'm watching something and a character says something out loud to no one, and it's not like, you know, Shakespearean monologue or something going on here, and I'm supposed to believe that this is really just the person talking to themselves, it's not that I can't believe that, because I can believe that, and I think that it can come off realistically and naturally, because, like I said, in my real life, there are times, of course, when I say something out loud and no one else is there. Mm-hmm. But the things you say in those moments are not important information things. It's like an, oh, shit, or you know, whatever, like,
yes, like an interjection.
Yes, an interjection, or just something small and unimportant.
Mm-hmm.
It's never information like me realizing something and saying it out loud.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's where I think the line is drawn, and when it becomes a problem is when we're getting information about this character through him talking to himself. I never go in the kitchen and go, I really like cooking. I'm going to cook these things today. Here are the ingredients I need
sure?
to cook with.
I hear you mumbling to yourself in the kitchen a lot.
Wow.
So, I had a reason for mentioning Amy Yazbek's THOs. There was actually a reason behind it, believe it or not.
Yeah?
And the reason is that it's the only thing in this movie that's worthy of anything above a PG rating. And that's another thing that I wanted to say about this, is that this movie is incredibly tame.
Yeah, it is incredibly
tame.
It's unfortunately tame, I think, is almost a better description for it.
There's really no gore to speak of.
Yeah, this movie could definitely handle, like, a good smattering of blood here and there.
Yeah, I think so. I'm going to have to apologize for the truck driving past our house screaming in Japanese, because it's
election season.
or erection season.
And that's what politicians do here, is they drive around in trucks and scream at you.
Yes. And also, if you hear our cat mewling in the background, it's because she's in heat. So I apologize for all of the random noises. This is just maybe the most inopportune time to be recording a podcast.
There it is.
Such is life.
Indiana Jones is going to show up any second now. And then some alien spaceship's going to come.
In a fridge.
I love that movie so much.
You're kidding. Oh, okay. I just looked up and saw your face. And I'm like, oh, good. Thank God. You're kidding.
Oh, good. We don't have to get a divorce.
Something I did notice in the movie here is that the obituary that Jesse looks at for his grandfather, according to that obituary, Jesse's grandfather was almost 106 years old when he died. Well, not died, but when he was buried.
You know, he does say something later where he talks about, I think he says something like, I was waiting 70 years for someone to dig me up.
Right.
And then later he talks about being 170 years old or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And so the math works out.
The math does work out.
That's just ridiculous.
It is a little bit ridiculous. I don't know. There's some other weird plot things that I don't quite understand. Apparently he found the skull originally in like some kind of Aztec or Mayan pyramid. And when he found it, he will come to learn later that he got in a fight with his partner Slim over it. And he ended up killing Slim because of it, like over the fight. And the whole thing behind the skull is that whoever owns the skull has immortal.
Right.
Yeah. Right. So they have eternal life. Which
they do?
Yes.
Eternal life?
I think so. Isn't that right? I thought that's what Jesse said when he was reading through the
maybe.
Book.
I don't know. One of my problems with this movie is I don't understand what the hell the skull does.
Okay, as far as I know, the skull grants immortal life to anyone who owns it.
But it doesn't make you young, and Gramps thought that it was going to make him young?
It thought it was going to keep him young, I thought.
But he was never young to begin with. He was like 100 when he died.
I know, and that's what confuses me. I'm not sure exactly what the skull is supposed to do. I thought that if you just
have it...
It
can also let you travel through time.
Apparently. I don't know if that's the skull doing that. Is that the skull doing that, or is that just the house? Because the house, we come to learn, is some kind of temple that Gramps says later. I don't know. As this movie goes on and more things are revealed, you realize that none of it really makes sense.
And no.
It's just wacky for the sake of wacky.
They tell us really early on in the scene when Gramps first puts the skull into the living room.
Yes.
And he tells us that he says something about the house being a temple. And I thought that was just kind of like metaphor.
Yeah.
Because the skull was there.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
That's what I thought it was. But then I kind of have come to believe that it's actually supposed to be a Mayan temple.
Yes.
With the rooms leading to different places and times,
yeah,
I guess.
I don't understand.
When the skull is inside?
And also they mention the Aztecs earlier in the movie.
Yes.
And there are references online that say that the things in this movie are, in fact, Mayan. So I don't know.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is it?
You know, whatever. It's the same thing.
Under what circumstances was Grandpa buried?
What? Why? Why does that matter?
Well, because if he was buried, then you assume that he died. But if he had the skull, then how did he die?
But I don't think the skull makes you immortal.
I think it does. I think that's what Jesse said.
But Gramps dies again. And how does his other slim razor? How does he live this long?
That's another plot hole that I was going to mention is that Slim, the partner Slim Razor, who apparently was shot by Gramps and died, shows up again as a zombie that's very similar to Gramps, but he never had the skull. So how did he live so long?
Like I said, I don't think that the rules of the skull make any sense or are ever clearly explained.
Well, nothing. By the time you get to the point in this movie when a bedroom becomes a jungle that has dinosaurs in it for no discernible reason, you realize that there's not really a lot of point in trying to pick this apart.
That's the thing, is that I know that it doesn't make any sense. I know that the skull is just a MacGuffin anyways. It's just a plot enabler and it doesn't make a difference. And that plus the fact that Gramps, when he's in the living room, he basically gives the movie free rein because he says, it don't know time or space or any of that hogwash, but the forces of evil are always after that skull, so you got to help me protect it. There you go. He just gave the movie free rein to do whatever it wants, wherever and whenever it wants, and have people attacking them constantly. And that's what the movie winds up being, is it just winds up being jumping around from place to place and time to time with people chasing them. And for this skull that apparently different people want it for different reasons, because like we've got the jungle guy who's going to put it like on an altar, and then the tribesmen later who are going to try and use it in a sacrifice. Yeah. And it's just a MacGuffin. It is whatever it needs to be for those people to
right.
steal it.
It is the object of desire for characters to pursue it and become, you know, to create conflict so that the movie can move forward. Right. I think that trying to pick this apart and trying to figure out where its logic lies
is pointless
because there is no logic in this. It is really, really wacky and off the wall, and that's fine. Like I'm not really interested in picking it apart, but we haven't really been very good about explaining what the core story is. The core story is basically after Jesse moves into this house, he finds photographs of his grandfather and, you know, the skull that his grandfather dug up from the pyramid, and he and his friend Charlie, who shows up with his girlfriend Lana, who's mm-hmm. played by Amy Yazbek, as we mentioned. He goes with his friend Charlie to dig up his grandpa because they assume that he'll have the skull with him.
Right, because they say that that he would be buried like an Aztec.
Right,
why?
Exactly. By the Aztecs. Where are we in the United States?
I think the house is in L.A. somewhere.
Is it?
Yeah,
were
it's like a real residence.
Were there Aztecs in Los Angeles?
Yeah, sure. No.
Were there?
No.
Okay. We're totally missing the fact that fucking Bill Maher is in this movie right now.
Yeah, why is he here?
What is Bill Maher? Well, he was a stand-up comedian first, and I don't know, it's weird in today's context seeing him as kind of a comedian slash political talking head.
Yeah.
I mean, he's become very, very outspokenly political, so much so that he's kind of a political figure now.
Yeah.
I don't know, kind of an Al Franken kind of thing. Al Franken was kind of the same way. Al Franken's a fucking senator now, so, you know, from SNL to the Senate.
Yeah. It happens.
Yeah, it definitely happens. So yeah, I kind of see Bill Maher as that. So when you look back at this movie, this was still him as a stand-up, and he's in this weird little horror comedy. It's really strange to see him in this, but naturally he plays an asshole, because what else is he going to play?
Some random stuff. Like the car, the car that they drive in this, the 1986 Alfa Romeo Spider.
Yes.
A different version of this same car was the one that was used in The Graduate.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that. That's interesting.
Charlie
is, we haven't talked about Charlie's actor. Charlie is played by Jonathan Stark, who is an actor who's been a lot like what's her name? Lar Park Lincoln. He was in a bunch of random single TV episodes, according to his IMDb page. But he's also a writer, and he wrote most of the sitcom According to Jim, starring Jim Belushi. So condolences to Jonathan Stark for that.
The thing about Charlie's character that always baffles me when I go back, and it's been a few years and I rewatch this movie again, is that I never remember or expect him to be such a big part of the movie. Like when he first shows up, I'm just like, oh, okay, here's some
comic relief
with some random people who are going to be a part of this movie for a few minutes and maybe cause some problems and be in the background. But Charlie is almost equally important as the main character.
Yeah. Definitely. And of course, we've got Royal Dano, who plays Gramps. Royal Dano being a legendary character actor who had a year that spanned over like 40 years or something like that. Just incredible, incredible stuff. Is that what I said? What did I say?
I thought you said a year that spanned over 40
years. I'm sorry,
a
career. That's what I meant. A career that spanned over 40 years. Mm. That would be quite the feat, wouldn't it? A year that spanned 40 years?
Maybe he had the skull with him.
Ah, yes, that because it don't respect no time or space, or I don't know what he says. What is it?
Something like that. Also, this movie suggests that communism makes the stars fade away.
It does, and it also says that, yeah, this movie's surprisingly political, because it's got a few words to say about President Ronald Reagan as well.
Yeah, it does. It does talk about Reagan. I thought that I didn't take the communism joke as a political joke. I just thought it was funny. What's up with this Halloween party?
Who decorated for this?
Yeah, who did decorate for it?
They've been sitting in the basement with Gramps for hours, we're led to believe, listening to him tell stories of the old days. And they come upstairs and there are people dancing and the whole place is decorated. And then Charlie just says...
He's like, oh, I invited some people over for Halloween, which apparently it's Halloween.
Yes.
Same slugs problem right there.
Exactly.
Is...
Very convenient. And they let us know... Actually, they're kind enough to let us know in the scene where they dig up Gramps and he reveals himself as a cowboy zombie. Sorry.
Cowboy zombie.
I just realized what we were watching. And they say what year it is. He asks what year it is, and they're like, it's October 30th, 1986. And I'm like, oh, okay. Gotcha. Halloween. It's Halloween tomorrow. So
I roll my eyes so hard when horror movies throw Halloween into the mix, but it has nothing to do with Halloween whatsoever. Like when it's a movie where it's like, they're going to pull up some contrived, overused, you know, oh, on Halloween, we can raise the soul of our great aunt, whatever thing, making Halloween be some important supernatural date or something like that. Mm-hmm. That's fine when they do that, because then it has a purpose. But setting it on Halloween and then having it have no effect whatsoever. I mean, I guess in this movie, the point of it is that... that Gramps can come upstairs and be around a bunch of people and it's okay because they think he's in costume.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
That's the reason we have it here.
That's exactly
right. At least
right.
What they use it for.
Yeah, and Gramps, there's a moment that's kind of sad. I actually feel really bad for Gramps in the scene, but when he comes back to the house and he's ready to go out on the town and do some... two-stepping or whatever the fuck he says he's gonna do. Then he catches a glimpse of himself in the mirror and he starts crying. And he says the Z word. He says that he's a 170-year-old zombie.
He later calls himself a 170-year-old fart.
Yes, he does say that as well. But he cries over being 170 years old and looking the way he does. But he was buried when he was like 105. He could not have looked that good. So, I mean, I'm
but I
I'm
thought
just
I thought he was under the impression that he was going to get young again.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know. I didn't get that from this.
In that same scene, he said something about it restoring his youth or something like that.
Oh, okay.
I think.
Right on. Well,
I thought he felt like he was going to get young again. But again, what does the skull do? I don't know. Nobody knows. Whatever it wants to, because this movie told us from the beginning they were going to do whatever they wanted to do with the skull.
Oh, look, this big guy is Buzzsaw from The Running Man, and the guy that he's knocking off the balcony here is Kane Hodder. Kane Hodder is probably most famous for playing Jason Voorhees in a few Friday the 13th movies.
Really?
Yep. Yeah, there's a couple of things that I wanted to mention. We always do this, but there are notes that I've got. I want to go back and...
Before you do that, I want to throw in another Friday the 13th connection. So the score in this movie is Harry Manfredini.
Yes, that's right.
And... he did 1, 2, and 4 from the House series because, of course, 3 wasn't really a House movie.
Right.
And he did a bunch of the Friday the 13th movies, too. So that's another Friday connection. You said there was another one. I don't remember who you said.
His Friday scores are remarkably Bernard Herrmann-esque. And I mentioned Bernard Herrmann last week with Sleepaway Camp, too, because I think that composer was also kind of not maybe copying Bernard Herrmann intentionally, but copying... Henry Manfredini, who was subsequently copying Bernard Herrmann. But yeah, I think.
But anyway, so Manfredini did, he did a lot of that stuff. He's got a lot of B horror stuff to his credit, like Wishmaster. And then I was scrolling through his IMDb stuff, and he's got my all-time favorite movie on there, A Talking Cat.
Oh my God!
Actually, I think he does all the stuff for that guy. That guy's name is, the guy who did all the 1313. They're all like, he churns them out. He films them in his mansion out in Hollywood.
Oh,
and
I
don't remember his name. He goes by a lot of different names.
I don't know.
But they're like really, 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 really bad as, like, he filmed A Talking Cat, I think, in 24 hours or something like that.
Wow.
They recorded all the voices for A Talking Cat in 15 minutes.
Oh my God. I think, like, we've done what is referred to as the best bad movie ever made, The Room, on this podcast before, but I think that A Talking Cat, because you have to read it like that.
Right.
Because the question marks are in the title.
Uh-huh.
So I believe that A Talking Cat.
Well, it's actually what, an interrobang?
It is an interrobang. A Talking Cat!
But actually, it's like an interrobang plus one more exclamation point, I think. I think it goes exclamation point, question mark, exclamation point.
Well, that's just absurd. I think it might actually be the worst movie I've ever seen. And I mean that in all seriousness. It might be the worst fucking movie I've ever seen. It's hard to sit through. It's super hard. It's harder to sit through than...
It's pretty fantastic. It was on Netflix before. If it's still on there, or on Hulu, I don't remember. I'm one of the two. But if it's still out there, you should totally watch it and
it
all
might,
of the other stuff that he does.
It might still be. I don't know.
I think the 1313 stuff, they call it... It's like a new genre of horror. They call it boxer briefs horror or something.
What?
Where it's just about how many shots you can get of boys in boxer briefs.
Is there something inherently gay about the
genre?
Yeah,
one of his fake names is Richard Chaser.
Okay. Oh, wait. Okay. I've looked up his filmography before.
Yeah.
Yes. Okay, you're right. He does. He makes a lot of gay movies. That's cool. let's see. One of the lines that I thought was kind of fun was when Gramps has his crying scene when he realizes that he's just an old zombie. He says, "I ain't gonna die if it's the last thing I do." And I want you to think about that sentence for more than 8 seconds, because I want to see you get a nosebleed. That's what will happen. It does not compute. We are way behind the movie, but fuck it, it's fine. The scene where Charlie and Gramps go for a drive in his car, you mentioned the car already. They go out to a hillside and get drunk under the stars. And I wanted to mention this really interesting article that I read about something that an author named Tim Urban calls a death progress unit, or a DPU. And this actually describes the level of technological advancement that would be required to make a time traveler die of shock, literally die of shock. And his whole point is that the DPU is getting shorter and shorter and shorter as technology, you know, exponentially advances and whatnot. But what I found interesting about that in relationship to this movie and Gramps getting in the car is that Gramps gets in that car and has zero reaction. None whatsoever. And then he comes back to the house and he's watching TV and has zero reaction to the TV. And in fact, makes a really dumb 80s joke like, "There's a bunch of channels and there ain't nothing on," and all that shit, right?
Yeah.
He calls it a box, whatever. But then at the same time, he's freaking out about the tissue box and asking where they all come from.
Yeah. It's like they go for the fish out of water thing for like 5 seconds and then they're like, "Yeah, we're bored with that."
In the scene where he's, we talked about the Ronald Reagan dig. I want to, expound on that a little bit. In that same scene where he's watching TV, he's actually watching a Ronald Reagan movie that I think I did as much research as I could. I dug as deep as I could. And I think that it is Louis R. Foster's Cavalry Charge from 1951. I think that's the movie.
The movie that's playing.
Yeah. So if you're interested in that particular Ronald Reagan movie, I think it's Cavalry Charge. I'm pretty sure it is. But it was hard to pin down. Yeah.
Anyways, the fish out of water thing with Gramps is like he doesn't he doesn't really react to anything. He drives the car. He gets in the car and he drives it. And
poorly,
then,
but...
Poorly. He, and then when they're really drunk, he knows enough about the time they're in to be like, I'm going to drive home.
I
you
better
shouldn't drive.
Drive. Yeah.
And it's like, you know nothing about drunk
like,
driving.
What are you talking about?
What, that's not a thing. And then later when he does the same sort of like having too much knowledge about the present day that he's in kind of thing, when he's talking about the Old West and he's like, all these books and movies, they don't tell you how it really was. And I'm like, isn't this still the first 24 hours that you've been here?
Yeah, you've learned a whole lot.
How do you know what the books and movies tell you about the Old West and that it's incorrect?
Yeah. That's pretty funny. To support the claim that this is actually a pretty funny movie, there are some lines that are somewhat inexplicable, but in their kind of non sequiturness, I find them very funny. One in particular is when Bill Maher refers to Charlie as Bozo the Clown, mm-hmm. and Charlie's retort is Bozo the Death Machine. Just comes from nowhere, but it's kind of fucking great.
So they did the we missed it about 5 minutes ago. Yeah, we missed everything about 5 minutes ago. But they're in a jungle now. They opened one of the doors in the house, and now there's a jungle, and they went into it, and it's a prehistoric jungle.
Indeed it is.
Indeed
oh,
it is.
Oh, our hint. I'm sorry. Our hint was the shot that had the big, Brontosaurus in it, and Brian Hoover on Facebook. I think he's guessed stuff before, but our friend Brian Hoover correctly guessed it, having not even ever seen this movie.
That's
I don't
impressive.
Know how that happened, but he wants to plug his short horror film, The Dormitory, and you can support that. It is currently in production, and you can
here
support
in Japan.
That's right, here in Japan, and you can support that project at GoFundMe.com/IowaHorrorInJapan. So go check that out and throw him a little cash because it's going to be great.
Yes, it is. And yours truly may even have an audio cameo.
You might have a cameo in it, not to spoil anything.
So what was I saying about the jungle? Oh yeah, Men in Black totally ripped off this movie.
How?
Because he pulls out the big gun. Charlie has the big gun. He has the Uzi.
Right.
And then he's like, here's what you get. And he gives him this teeny tiny little gun.
It's really strange, though, because first of all, Charlie, why the fuck do you have a machine gun? And second, when you give when you're in an obviously dangerous situation, enough so that you actually have a real machine gun and you hand someone else a pistol, Jesse's reaction is, what do I do with this, light cigars or something like that? And Charlie says, no, you shoot people with it, duh. First, I would like to appreciate this movie a little bit for not burying the lead and understanding that handguns are tools for killing people, period. And they address it outright. Very nice. Good job, House 2, the second story. Secondly, once they're actually in for real danger and Jesse tries to use the gun, it is a fucking lighter. Charlie's an asshole. What the fuck?
Yeah, true. He is an asshole.
What?
Yeah,
what
it's like real
that?
Danger. Like, they're in a serious situation. And he asks him if it's going to be a fake gun, and he says no. And then it is. But anyway, so they do that the one time, and then Men in Black rips them off all those years later. I'm sure that's totally what happened.
Yes.
They were watching this movie, and they were like, no one's going to know. Let's steal this idea. And then they do the small weapon thing again, because the big hulky guy...
Buzzsaw from The Running Man.
Right. He has a machete or something, or a short sword, or whatever it is he pulls out. And then Charlie's got like a little teeny knife, and he looks at it and he's like, oh no. And then he runs off. So they do the same gag twice. Whatever. Again. We have a pterodactyl now.
We do have a baby pterodactyl
in
this
movie.
First
we had a big pterodactyl and it stole the skull.
We sure do. And believe it or not, that's not the strangest animal that's going to pop up in this movie.
Yeah, that's true.
There's one after this that I can't even begin to explain why or how or whose idea it could have possibly been.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
yeah.
it just seems like a bad acid trip that was put to paper somehow.
A lot of this movie is kind of a bad acid trip.
So I'm not really sure. But what we've got going on now is that Charlie and Jesse are in the prehistoric jungle bedroom place, and Jesse is climbing a tree to retrieve the skull, which is currently in a nest with a baby pterodactyl. And it's at this point, like, they walk into the jungle from the bedroom, and one of the lamps from the bedroom has somehow transformed into kind of a jungle motif lamp to kind of show the transition, I guess, from the bedroom to the jungle. How mm-hmm. that happens, I'm not sure, but at this point, I've decided to stop asking questions
right.
about
the movie. You just don't need to ask questions about this movie. Just let it be. We have a jungle in a room now. Fine. Why? It doesn't matter.
That's true. It doesn't matter. There's little in this movie that actually matters.
But it's, that's why I love it, this it is, movie, is because it's just so ridiculous.
It is kind of a good example of just allowing a movie to wash over you, and not in like the way that it's like, oh, what an ephemeral kind of ecstatic experience it is to watch this, but more like, just don't question it, just experience it.
Yeah,
and that's
just
what
let
it is.
Go.
This movie is kind of an experience.
You know what? And like, they follow through with some plot lines and stuff in this movie. I really appreciate, like, when they get bored of them, they throw them away. But the whole thing with his girlfriend being working for a record company and looking for talent.
That
and
whole
then
thing
Lana.
Just,
yeah, it vanishes.
They work so hard on that storyline and then it just disappears.
Yes, it does just disappear. But they do, like, they follow through with it until they're bored with it.
I guess, yeah, that's an interesting way to look at it. It starts in the very first scene with Kate. She's on the phone with her boss, and it's clear that they're having problems finding a new recording artist, a new hot recording artist. And then Charlie and Lana show up, and in the morning, Charlie puts on one of Lana's, you know, tapes, and she starts singing and dancing to it really loud. And Kate comes in and says, "What is that great music?" or whatever the fuck. Mm-hmm. And Lana says, "Oh, well, that's me." And Kate, of course, from there goes, "Oh, well, I think that we need to talk to my record producer." And that's where Bill Maher comes in, because he plays her boss, the record label producer. And they do all of this, and they set up this lunch date, and Lana and Kate and Bill Maher's character go out on this lunch date to talk about her demo and to do all this stuff. And during that time, that's when Jesse and Charlie listen to Gramps' story. They set up this whole story about the recording artist and Lana being this new recording artist for her, or might be, you know, they haven't signed anything mm-hmm. yet, but it's a potential thing. And then they just throw it away.
Well, they're just trying to, in the end, it's just used to get rid of the girlfriends.
It is, but the device that they use to get rid of the girlfriends has nothing
yes,
to
true.
Do.
Yes, true, and it's an extreme, like additional story piece to just get rid of the girlfriends. But it's also, you're saying, again, why question this movie?
Right.
but like, the girl that he meets, Rochelle... Is that her name? Rochelle?
Rochelle, who's apparently an old flame.
An old flame
Very drunk and just all over him.
Uh-huh. And she winds up kissing him when she sees him. And his girlfriend, Kate, doesn't see it, but John, Bill Maher's character, sees it.
Right.
And then
he tells Kate,
right. And Kate gets angry and whatever. And so you're thinking, oh, okay, well, I mean, it's kind of stupid that we... bothered to have girlfriends in the beginning if we were just going to immediately get rid of them and replace them with new girlfriends. Why not just have them be single and have them collect these, you know, supernatural induced whatever girlfriends throughout the movie, like the virgin Mexican
get. Right.
Like, if we're going to do that anyways, then why bother having them have girlfriends in the beginning? Just have them be single. But the point is we introduced Rochelle, and it's like, okay, fine. So they brought a girlfriend in so that we could hate her and get rid of her and then get a new girlfriend. But then we do nothing with Rochelle either.
Yes.
Like, she shows up and she kisses him, and you're like, oh, no, now his girlfriend's going to break up with him. But I guess it's okay because he's got this new girlfriend, Rochelle. Who's,
right.
But then...
That's the only... As soon as all of that's done, as soon as Rochelle's purpose...
It's about to be done here.
Yeah, it's about to happen. But as soon as Rochelle's purpose... of getting the girls and Bill Maher
out of the house
is finished, then Rochelle also leaves the movie.
Yeah.
What was the point of having those characters in the movie in the first
just
place?
Just don't have any of them.
Yeah.
Just have Charlie show up.
Yeah, yes. Charlie shows up and Charlie and Jesse can do it all together.
Jesse moves into a new house. He's apparently an artist. We don't see him do anything with that whatsoever.
I mean, here's the thing. This is ostensibly... Again, I have qualms with it, but this is ostensibly a horror movie or a half horror movie, right? And you've got all these characters in it, which all leave, but don't die.
Yeah, right? They should just die.
They should die. Like, that's that the, like, if you're going to have all these characters in the movie and set up these stories
that you want to get rid of anyways, then just kill them.
Yeah, you're in a horror movie. That's what you do. I don't know.
Yeah, true. They either, all of these characters who are standing here, it should have been only Charlie and Jesse, or the other three characters should have been killed.
And what happened to the party exactly?
Yeah, it just ended.
Just over all
it
those people.
It started whenever
it
wanted to, and it ended whenever it wanted to, without any aid from the hosts whatsoever.
I didn't pay close enough attention later in the movie, but I imagine the decorations also just disappear as handily as they appeared out of nowhere, right?
I know we see him cleaning up for like 2 seconds, but he's barely made a dent.
And, oh, okay, yeah.
And
oh, yeah, just picking up a couple of cups before Michelle jumps him.
Yeah, but the decorations are still all up and the party's like still full force at that point. But I don't know. I think the decorations do vanish, or maybe they don't vanish. It doesn't matter, though.
Nope.
No, it
again,
doesn't.
Again, no. We come back to that over and over again.
See... This is my favorite line in the whole movie.
Oh, it's
right
great.
Here, the delivery.
I'm sorry, we're listening to it. It's
funny. So she says he
opens up the
he
closet.
Opens up the closet where he just threw Gramps inside the closet, and
he comes clean and says
and
that,
he's like, "Listen, here's what's been going on: zombie grandfather, cowboy,
yes, zombie
jungle."
Cowboy.
Pterodactyl, whatever, and he's going on and he says all this stuff, and that's what's going to be in the closet when I open it, and not the girl who you suspect that I've hidden in the closet. Mm-hmm. What kind of an idiot would hide a girl in a closet when his girlfriend is in the house still?
No.
like invite her over at the same time, and then I mean that's just assuming he's incredibly dumb. But he says it's not a girl in the closet, and then he opens up the closet, and of course it is Rochelle in the closet in her maid outfit, and he closes the closet, and his girlfriend says, "Well, what did you think was going to be in the closet?" And he says, "A mummy, or maybe even a baby pterodactyl." And the way he delivers the line is just perfect.
And now the girls and John are out of the picture, John being Bill Maher's character. And John in that scene, to get to that point, he was awfully nosy. I just don't know why they didn't kick him out of the house. Like, it's my fucking house, dude. Get out. You're done. Done, son. I don't know. He opens the closet and he sees Rochelle in there and asks her, "Hi, Rochelle, what are you doing here?" Which is a really good question.
It is a good question.
I don't even have to, like, when I saw Rochelle in there before he said that, I was like, "What are you doing here?"
And then he asks.
So I don't even have to ask the questions anymore because the movie's asking the questions for me at this point.
Well, and the thing is that this movie, when it does ridiculous stuff, like Gramps goes in the closet and then he's not there and Rochelle's there, and you're just like, "What the hell, movie? Come on, Gramps was in there." And then they show us later there's like a secret revolving door. Every time I get annoyed and I'm about to be like, excuse me, then the movie, mostly it backs itself up.
Right.
It just doesn't care.
And I do want to say something about the screenwriting because, and I know that sounds strange in this context, but as weird as it sounds, everything that has happened since the Halloween party started up until I guess the girls left, structurally, all of that stuff is exactly how you should tell any story, ideally. Everything leading to the next thing.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, for example, and the way that I can really tell this when I'm researching a movie for Popcorn Poops is that when I write notes on a movie and I have a hard time finding a break point where, like, the movie scenes start bleeding together because the one thing leads to the next thing so well,
you know that it was written well.
Exactly. And as crazy as it sounds, everything from the moment the party starts until the girls leave is kind of perfect storytelling.
Yeah,
like,
no,
it's
I agree.
How you
and
tell a
actually,
story
most
in that
of
way.
The movie was like that.
Content
for me, taking,
aside, in content take, aside, the act of cause and effect is in full force.
In taking notes for this movie, I found that generally in the movie as a whole, it was hard to find places to throw those breaks in, and I eventually just had to, in my notes, you know, just put headers here and there because I had to have headers at some point.
Yeah,
but yeah, I agree. It's It's weird how this movie is like that, how they're... That's why I think
there's
it succeeded
here.
Instead of it being just a real bad horror movie.
Right, which is why I don't think it's really a bad movie, because I think that there's definitely competency here.
Yeah.
Clearly, there's
competency. Even though generally, if you go on the internet and you look up stuff, people just totally throw this movie aside and just shit all over it. But I don't think it's that bad. I think that the people who made this knew what they were making. They were very self-aware of what they were making. So we saw Gramps feeding his... We haven't talked about
we
the
haven't
weirdest
talked about
creature
it yet.
In this movie.
We did mention it a little bit earlier, but we didn't say what it was. There is a dog caterpillar hybrid mutant thing.
Dinosaur thing?
I guess. That
it was from the dinosaur jungle world.
Yeah, it was from the jungle, the prehistoric jungle bedroom. And it's the weirdest thing ever. Like, I don't think
I like it.
I don't like it.
It makes me very uncomfortable when I look at it. It's got like a dog face and a caterpillar body, but it's very large, like lapdog size.
It's gross.
It is gross.
It's gross, and it's not a very good puppet. I don't know. It just doesn't look good. When they handle it, it's obvious that they're handling it kind of with kid gloves because it's probably really, you know, fragile or something like that. It's awkward. Whenever Gramps is like handling the thing and like letting it down off of his lap or whatever, it just looks strange.
Mm-hmm. At one point we just missed the moment, but Gramps was feeding caterpillar dog with a baby bottle filled with beer.
Yes.
It was really awkward scene and made me uncomfortable again.
There's a lot of
Anyways, do you know what the thing's name is? The caterpillar dog?
Oh, he says it. Mm-hmm. What is it?
Bippy.
Bippy,
okay. You know what? Why?
No.
Bippy apparently is a Midwest euphemism for ass.
What? Okay. What does that have to do with anything?
I mean, I said why as though that like explained something.
No, that doesn't explain something.
It doesn't explain anything.
You don't mean to say why. You mean to say, and you know what?
And you know what? Also... Also, here's this
also,
somehow
here's something
related information.
Not related. Here's also information that is unrelated entirely.
But they must have known it going into it because, I mean, he's a cowboy, so clearly that's why.
Okay. All right, if you say so. We didn't mention what happens after the girls leave, that Rochelle in the closet... happens because apparently there's a rotating wall inside the
mm-hmm.
closet.
Yeah.
And on one side was Grandpa and the other side was Rochelle. And when Jesse comes back, Grandpa comes out and he's like, oh, I got to show you something. And he goes back in the closet and flips the wall around and there's Rochelle again, which raises like every question that is answered. That's a question that's answered. Why is Rochelle there? That answers the question. But it also raises like two more questions. And that is, what's on the other side of the rotating wall, for one?
Yes. Where does this lead to?
And number two, what is Gramps doing back there for the extended time that Charlie and Jesse are dealing with getting Rochelle out of the house? Because he goes back there and Rochelle pops out again, and you're just assuming that he's just back there.
I assumed it was like a passageway to somewhere else in the house.
The basement, maybe,
yeah.
Or something? I don't know.
Because the next shot is of Gramps
in
the basement.
They don't explain that. Oh, my God.
John, this is the best part of the movie. We have reached the best part of the movie.
Ratzenberger. God bless this man. Oh, I love this. This is hands down the best shit in the fucking movie.
Yeah,
maybe
absolutely.
The best shit in any movie ever.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing.
John Ratzenberger shows up in this movie kind of surprisingly and interestingly, because in the first film, George Wendt was in the first movie, and of course both of them play like best, I think they're like best friends on the TV show Cheers. So between these two movies in this franchise, you've got kind of a pseudo Cheers reunion thing going on, which is really strange. But John Ratzenberger here, it plays the electrician Bill,
and he's awesome. He's amazing.
He is amazing, and he is here because kind of amazingly, he is paying off a throwaway line that was mentioned at the earlier in the movie that I didn't really pay any attention to. And
but again, this movie pays attention to that stuff.
It does. This movie does pay attention to itself. And
they
and,
make her part of, they make Kate part of a record company, and they follow through with it. And
right.
they say that the house has problems, and she's going to deal with the wiring because there's electricity wiring problems.
Exactly. One of the first things they say when they walk in the house is she flips a switch and she's like, oh, the light's out in here. We'll, you know, we'll call somebody to deal with that.
And I guess they did.
And they did, because here he is. I don't know. It's surprising.
It's amazing that we're like impressed by them
this basic competency.
But anyway, so the electrician shows up at the house and he's hilarious, and he goes around breaking stuff at first, and kind of gets Jesse out of the room, because now Jesse and Charlie, they know that Gramps was attacked the night before by some kind of, well, Gramps said it was like 20 or 30 people or something, mm-hmm. but actually it was like two. I guess they're supposed to be Mexican tribesmen or
right.
something.
And we're not. Yes, and. And when they pop up to me, it's like, and racism.
Yes, true.
Or cultural appropriation at the very least, but it's you know, at the least problematic, at the worst, flat out racism. And it gets worse. It's not just that, but it does.
I mean, maybe they're like the worse. Aztecs. Maybe that's what this is coming back to. No?
I guess so. I'm not sure. It's pretty strange, but this movie does get into weird territory, especially with the virgin character that pops up, that sticks around for the rest of the movie, who's only in this movie. Like, we're an hour into this, which means we've only got like 25 or 30 minutes left.
Mm.
And by the time she shows up, there's only like 15 minutes left in the movie, and she manages to get herself kidnapped,
mm-hmm.
or she manages to be in situations where she needs to be rescued no less than two times in 15 minutes.
Yes, true.
Not only that, but she has zero lines of dialogue.
Right. She has zero lines of dialogue. However, she does cook and serve them dinner.
She cooks and serves them dinner, and she's credited as virgin.
Mm-hmm.
So that's that.
Yeah, but I mean, I guess this could be like the Aztec or Mayan stuff.
I mean, but what are you going to do? It's the fucking 80s, right?
Yes, true. Right?
We're better than that now? Are we better? You know, I would say that we're better than the, you know, the racism and the sexism.
But
and
you watched
and
Transformers
now.
Last night, so.
I did. I watched Transformers Revenge of the Fallen last night for the first time. And my God, I hate that fucking film. I hate it so much. It is offensively bad. It's not fun bad. It's not so bad it's good. It's just, I was kind of sick watching it. It's really that bad.
So we've missed the very best part of the movie.
We did.
While,
go ahead.
While
go, I know you want to talk about
Transformers. Bill Towner, I always thought he said Tanner, but his card reads Bill Towner,
oh, okay.
The electrician. He's been breaking stuff in the house, and when the guys come back, when Charlie and Jesse come back, because he insists that they come see what he's found, he's like, looks like you got some kind of alternate universe or something in here. I've been through this kind of thing before. You see this a lot in these old houses.
It's pretty great.
And you're just like, what? This guy is just going to be aware of this? And he has his own sword in his toolkit?
Yes, I'm so in love with how commonplace all of this is to him. He's just like, oh, it just happens, you know, no big deal. There's a moment when he introduces himself to Charlie as the electrician, and Charlie's kind of taken aback a little bit. And Charlie, what does he say? He says, Bill Towner, electrician. And Charlie goes, Charlie, entrepreneur. There's a good delivery there. This is a funny fucking
there
movie.
There are some good deliveries in this movie. The pterodactyl line is really funny.
It's great. It's really
or maybe
it's really
even
great.
A baby pterodactyl.
I wonder if John Ratzenberger basically improvised his whole part, because it kind of feels that way.
It kind of feels like it, and it's perfect.
And you know what really gives that away is that in the scenes where he's talking, especially from this point forward, I don't think he gets much, but that first scene where he's introduced, you can really tell, like, those improvised scenes in movies generally, I think, when the other actors kind of hang back.
Yeah.
And you can feel them just being like, I'm going to let him do what he's doing.
Just going to let him do what he's going to do.
And you can feel it. It's not dialogue at that point anymore by the very definition of the word. He's very much controlling the scene. And I think that, that's because he was improvising. And he does a great job. He's hands down best part of this movie.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
See this a lot in these old houses. It's just fantastic. And he's bashed a hole in the wall and they've gone through and here's this Mayan or Aztec or whatever it's supposed to be. These ancient people who are battling them for the virgin.
Yeah.
They have on the table.
I think we can blame this scene 100% on the existence of Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom, which came out 3 years before this.
See, another connection. I'm telling you, it was a prequel.
What? Did you say that before?
Yeah, to the Crystal Skull.
Oh, right. Yes. Oh, wow. Okay. Good. Good. Yeah, all I got to say about the Temple of Doom thing is that if you copy a racist movie, you're going to get a racist movie. That's just what happens.
Yes, that's true. It's a true fact.
There is kind of a lame joke. Hey, is that a virgin? Because I've never seen one before that Charlie says. Har.
Pretty lame.
Har.
Yeah.
Lame joke.
And there are that do fall flat like that.
Definitely.
There definitely are. But for those jokes, the ones that exist that are funny, like all the stuff with the electrician, it makes up for it.
I kind of wish that they had given John Ratzenberger a death scene. I wish they had killed him in this and given him a really big, like, death montage
like
or something.
Like an outlandish, like over the top.
Oh, that would have been perfect. But
instead he shows up and they're like looking for him and thinking he's lost and he's still back there cleaning his sword and putting his stuff away and is like, oh yeah.
This is a great little bit of movie trivia. If you ask a movie buff, in what movie does John Ratzenberger play an interdimensionally traveling, swashbuckling electrician? It's a pretty tough one. It's a tough one, I think. It's a good question.
Bill Towner, electrician and adventurer, is what his business card says, which the Mexican virgin sniffs.
Yes. This movie at that point when they leave Bill behind to fight the rest of the guys. And then by the time they come out, Bill's already out.
Back. Mm-hmm.
And Charlie, you'll notice, I don't know if you did, but I noticed that Charlie starts to ask Bill how he got out ahead of them. But then he stops because I think the movie knows just to not ask questions anymore.
Who cares?
It goes from raising a bunch of questions to asking questions of itself to then just letting shit happen.
Well,
this movie's very, very
again,
aware.
Self-aware. It's incredibly self-aware. This movie knows that it's a bad horror movie and that it doesn't matter in the end. Why do we have an alternate dimension inside the wall of the living room?
Because why not?
Right. Because we told you in the beginning that this skull, for whatever reason, being in this house is going to let time and space and whatever and suck evil forces toward it, attract evil forces.
Mm-hmm.
They just tell us in the beginning, here's what we're going to do, deal with it or turn off the movie because we're not going to answer questions and stuff. They don't care.
Bill left a huge mess and didn't fix a damn thing.
No, he did not. But he saved the princess.
Well,
our virgin.
I guess that's true, but so he's an abysmal electrician, but a legendary adventurer. Actually, his business cards. What does it say?
It said electrician and adventurer.
Electrician and adventurer. That's pretty great. I'm
if I ever make myself business cards for something, I'm going to put and
just
adventurer.
Addendum and adventurer.
Like no matter how mundane my actual job is.
Yeah, at this point, I just don't even know what the fuck's going on. They sit down to dinner.
After the virgin cooks it for them and serves them.
After the virgin cooks it for them, they sit down to dinner. And if you start this movie from this point, you might have a brain aneurysm.
Mm.
You watch the movie from the dinner scene and you're like, okay, what's going on here? There are two guys, a zombie cowboy, a dog caterpillar, a baby pterodactyl, and a non-speaking barefoot Mexican sacrificial virgin sitting at a table. It sounds like the start of a bad joke. Sitting down at a table, and then when the main dish is revealed, another zombie cowboy rises out of where their dinner was supposed
their
to be.
Their turkey should be.
And that's, attacks them.
That's a trope in these movies, isn't it? The whole, like, lifting the lid off the turkey plate and there being something terrifying or disgusting underneath
it. I want
to
ask you this. Did your family ever have
a lid over the turkey plate?
Platter
no,
that
never.
Had a lid? Mine never. Didn't either.
We had a big turkey platter.
But it's in every movie.
Yes, it is.
Every movie.
I've never actually seen one
I
in
haven't
my
either.
Life.
It's they're probably expensive.
I would guess so.
I bet. That's a lot of metal. It's a lot of stainless steel.
I really want one, though, so just for the sole purpose of having a Halloween party where I can lift the lid off of it and have something disgusting be underneath it.
Yeah.
Because, really, think about it. I mean, all these movies that have, like, you know, you lift it up and, like, the turkey comes to life, and but it's, like, half, you know, it's already carved or whatever. Or, like, there's maggots all over it or something like that. In-house... Three, they do that, right? There's like a turkey on the table and it's got maggots all over it or something.
I think so.
Or like
yeah.
A table full of rotting food.
Yeah. I
and
think
then the Friday, or not Friday, the nightmare one where the girl, all the food at the table gets gross or something like that. And she winds up.
Which one is it?
The one where. I forget which one it is. It's one of the girls. Her death is by turning half into a bug, into a cockroach or something.
Oh, it's that's a Nightmare on Elm Street.
Yeah, that's what I was saying.
Oh, it's oh,
it's
I don't.
Not Friday. It's Nightmare.
I can't remember which one it is.
I can't remember either.
Maybe
but anyways,
the Dream Child.
Maybe
the Dream Child
maybe,
Five. Is
maybe
that five?
Dream Child?
Maybe.
But there's a like table full of disgusting food thing in that too. That's something that happens a lot in these movies, and I'm okay with that. I think it's fine and gross.
I do want to talk a little bit about how this movie...
There's a horse. There's a whole stuffed horse behind
there him. There is. Actually, there's going to be a really amazing stop-motion zombie horse.
Yes, there
minute.
Is.
It's pretty cool.
This is cool. He looks out the window, and there's like an old West town outside the window.
Right. Which is a little only weird to me because they spend so little time here.
Yeah, it's also weird to me because suddenly he's just not here anymore and they don't explain it at all.
Right. Well, he jumps back in through a window and...
He jumps back in?
Yeah, he jumps back in through a different window and he gets back in the house.
Oh, I totally missed the scene where he jumped back in through
yeah,
the window.
Yeah, he does that. But yeah, he ends up in this western town and sees Charlie and the Virgin strung up and ready to be hanged in the gallows. So, you know... And then, of course, Slim Razor comes along on his kind of
and that's the last
cool,
we're
kind
see,
of shitty looking zombie horse.
That's the last we're going to see Charlie and the Virgin until the
very end
of the movie.
So what
we don't
to,
know
yeah.
how they get out of this situation. I guess we can assume that Jesse goes
Look
back
at that
and
zombie
saves
horse.
Him.
It looks
awesome.
So bad, but amazing.
Looks so awesome bad. That's the kind of bad that's great.
Yeah. Yeah, but they're only here for a minute. They start this shootout, and Jesse proves to be a terrible shot and then runs away and then jumps back in through a window. And that's they built this whole Old West town set just for, like, less than 5 minutes of screen time. It's really, really strange. I'm not sure.
It is strange.
You know what would be really handy right now?
Hmm.
That machine gun that Charlie had earlier. That's another thing about this movie. Even when he's supposed to have the machine gun in the earlier scenes in the jungle,
mm-hmm.
it disappears out of his hand at random moments when it would be totally useful. I don't think he actually ever uses it on anything. Does he? The machine gun?
I don't think so.
I don't think he
I'm
does.
I'm trying to think, and I don't think he does.
I don't know. Something I did want to talk about was other ways in which this movie is... not a bad movie and is kind of aware of storytelling techniques and and things that, you know, you should do when you're writing a screenplay. Earlier, you've got after the party when Kate is upset about Jesse being kissed by Rochelle or having Rochelle all over him and Gramps being, after having been attacked by the big guy. there are parallel scenes of Kate and Gramps resting, and both of them wanting to self-medicate.
Yes, that's right.
Because she's freaking out on the couch and she's laying down.
And she's like, give me a Valium.
Give me a Valium. And then we cut immediately to Grandpa, who asks for a beer because of his situation.
Mm-hmm. Or whiskey.
Whiskey or something like that. Yeah. So you've got these two characters that are kind of in the same situation that have stemmed from events that have happened in similar space and time.
Yep.
I don't know. It's interesting. And there's an awareness of those kind of parallels that this movie plays with that, again, supports my idea that this isn't actually a bad movie, which means we shouldn't actually be talking about it this month. But that's not my fault, is it?
Oh, shut up. Hey, didn't a similar thing happen in the first house with the cop showing up? Because of gunshots after he kills his... Well, he thought it was his wife, but it's the, what do they call it, Sandy Witch?
The hag. You know, I don't remember the first movie all that well.
It's been a minute since I watched the first movie, but I went back and looked up the summary, synopsis, so that I could refresh myself on it. In case you were wondering, this movie really doesn't have anything to do with the first movie.
Oh, we said that. It doesn't have anything to do with any of them. They're every single movie in this series. Especially the third one, because it's not actually even a house movie, but none of them have anything to do with each other. They're non-sequential,
yes,
standalone,
true.
All standalone. But which is why initially I let this go when you wanted to do this for the podcast, and I agreed to it is because yes, it's House 2, and we've never actually. This is technically the first sequel we've ever done on Popcorn Poops, isn't that right? Yeah,
I think so.
This is technically the first sequel we've ever, unless you count Die Hard, which is kind of a sequel to whatever. It doesn't. It's not a sequel because it's not really a sequel. Yeah, it's called House 2, but it's not. So,
anyways, though, so where did Slim Razor just pull that skull out of? From inside his stomach?
Yes.
Okay, that's cool.
Yes, that's right. It kind of...
And what happens here? This is important. What happens in this moment?
Reminds one of the pistol scene from Videodrome when James Woods pulls the pistol out of his stomach.
What happens? It looks like... Jesse gets intense, and then the skull gets bright, and then it blinds Slim Razor, and he falls down. I had to go back and rewatch that like two times because I was certain.
Oh,
that...
there's a little bit of gore. I forgot about this. When he initially kills Slim, or what he thinks is killing Slim, it's not really gore. It's not wet and oopy goopy like it should be, but. He is blowing someone's head off. So.
That's true. But why did the skull suddenly have the power to blind or distract or whatever it did to Slim Razor?
You're asking questions
it
again.
It just suddenly...
Sweetheart, you're asking questions again.
I know,
again.
But I had to go back and look at it like two times because I thought that Gramps or Charlie or somebody had come down... and shot Slim Razor, and that's why he got distracted. But no, what happens is the skull just seems to light up while Jesse is concentrating, I guess, and it looks like Slim gets blasted away. If nothing else, he gets, like, stumbled and phased. And I guess the skull does it to him, but why it attacked Slim and not Jesse, I don't know. Why Jesse can control it suddenly...
I can't even begin to tell you because
it doesn't matter.
Because it doesn't, again. Wow, man. We keep coming back to that. Doesn't matter, does it?
And then we have a sentimental moment between Gramps and Jesse.
We do. I did have more things to say about why this is actually kind of a good movie and how it understands parallel imagery and parallel ideas.
Mm-hmm.
And the other example I had of that is after Gramps gets attacked by the tribesmen for the first time, and Jesse finds him in the morning on the floor, and Gramps is explaining what happened. He's over-exaggerating what actually happened. He's saying that there were a bunch of people, and he was surrounded and all that kind of stuff. And if you'll notice, that's almost exactly how Ronald Reagan's character was talking in that movie. He was talking to a girl about how he was on the plains and he was surrounded by savages or whatever the fuck he was saying. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there was no way out and all this kind of stuff. So the, you know, Gramps was throwing shade on Ronald Reagan and saying that he never would have lasted in the old days. And in this movie, he's talking about how like it was just him and 15 guys against a horde of savages or whatever it is he says. And then come later in the movie, Gramps says basically the same thing about the tribesmen who attack him. I don't know. I think that that's intentional and interesting.
Yeah.
And proves that the movie, the screenwriter is aware of
What's going on. Yeah. Yeah. I think so. That was a good catch. Nice.
So that's kind of interesting to me. We're getting real close to the end of this movie. This is, as you said, a sentimental moment where Gramps has taken too many wounds, taken too many bullets to the gut, and he's going to move on to that great prairie in the sky.
Oh my God.
And also the cops are still here.
Yeah, the cops are still here.
And the purpose
I don't know what they've been doing this whole time.
The purpose of the cops in this movie is to, I guess, deliver the final blow to Slim. And also to completely overdo it when it comes to shooting up the house.
Right.
And just basically burn down the fucking house.
Right, burn down the house and basically also have it be like a no way out situation where Jesse's gotta like leave the universe.
Yeah.
Or leave his time
like
or
not,
something.
They don't explain why. And again,
I mean,
I'm not
well,
ask
you'll
why,
see right
but...
here what just happened is I guess the chief of police or whoever the guy was just got shot by Slim.
Yes.
So certainly Jesse would have been accused of having done that.
I suppose so. Yeah.
And I don't think you can shoot the chief of police and get away with that very easily.
You have to infer a whole lot in order to come to that.
And also the house is on fire. And so then he's just like, well, there's no option. I've just got to. Because Gramp says that he should figure out what he wants and use the skull to get it and then get rid of the skull.
Right.
So
what does he do?
He uses it, I guess. My interpretation is that he's using it to go back to the Old West because we've decided that's where we want to live is in the Old West because Gramp's stories were so wonderful on that night when they got drunk and listened to them.
I suppose. I don't know. I don't feel like they don't give a whole lot of great characterization for Jesse or Charlie as far as like their goals are
or desires or anything.
They almost do because you remember when Charlie and Lana show up for the first at the you know toward the beginning of the movie, they give Charlie a framed I'm really sorry about that really annoying truck driving by our house right now.
Politician.
Apparently that's legal here. So toward the beginning of the movie, Charlie
the
shows
framed
up.
Picture
framed
picture of his
framed
magazine.
Yeah, there's a magazine cover of Jesse on the front of Art in America or American Art or some kind of magazine like that. And we never find out what kind of artist he is.
Yep.
It never comes up again. We know he's an artist because of that, but it's never referred to again. We never see him work on art. We never see him do any kind of job to speak of. Meanwhile, his girlfriend Kate clearly has a job because she's working with her boss and stuff like that and calling him frequently. So yeah, I don't know that there's just not a lot there, right?
Yeah, there isn't a lot there. But I guess they really want to live in the Old West without antibiotics. So that's what they're going to do.
Without antibiotics. Did they bring the pterodactyl and the dog with them? The dog.
Yep,
thing?
they've got at least. I definitely saw the caterpillar dog. I think the pterodactyl's in the wagon too.
Oh, man.
They're just gonna ride off into the sunset and live in the Old West.
So they buried Gramps in the Old West and put the skull on top of the rock pile.
But isn't the skull like evil then? If forces of evil want it, like Gramps spent his whole life protecting
skull. But if Charlie and Jesse's central motivation is to find the skull and pursue it, does that make them evil? Are they actually evil?
True. Mm. But if they were protecting the skull from evil people like Gramps was doing and like they did for most of the movie, then that makes sense. But I don't know.
I
Doesn't matter.
Don't know. We're still asking questions, and that's our...
And still doesn't matter.
And it still doesn't matter.
The point is, in the end, I think this movie is super fun.
It is. It's a lot of fun. It's real goofy and off the wall, and it doesn't make sense, but it's funny.
It's funny.
It is funny.
It's funny, and it's fun, and...
Weird.
It's very weird, and... I don't think it's that bad.
I think
honestly.
The tagline for this movie was actually "It's getting weirder." I think that's the tagline,
and that's totally fine. I mean, House One was it's a pretty weird movie too, but this just takes it to a different level. It's a very different kind of weird. I recommend the House series in general. I love this series, except for the third one, but yeah. It's not a House movie.
It's not a House movie, and it's. If you're going to watch that movie, just watch Shocker, which isn't really a good movie either, but it's better than the horror show.
Yeah. But yeah, that's it for me. This has been fun.
Yeah.
That's it for my picks this month.
That is it for your picks. I've got one more next week, which we will announce in our closing bit. But yeah, I would recommend this too. It is a lot of fun. Doesn't make sense. It's kind of a good movie in ways, and it's also kind of a bad movie in ways. There are things that... It doesn't do so well that I think it tries to do well.
Things that it actually tries to do well right. That it doesn't succeed in. But for the most part, the stuff that's bad, they intended it to be that way, and it didn't come off in the way that most movies do when they try to be bad.
Right, right, exactly.
So, if nothing else, watch it for The Electrician.
Yeah, recommended, even though it doesn't belong in this month, because it's not really a horror movie, and it's not really a bad movie either, so... That's just where I stand, but that's okay. Well, I'll let it slide.
Well, it's my birthday month, so you can just...
Guaranteed next week will be both bad and a horror movie. Now that we've reached the end of the movie, we would like to read a 5-star review that we received on iTunes. This review comes from Drew Gleason with the subject line, "A good time for your ears and your brain." At first listen, the Popcorn Poops sound like an ordinary young couple from the South Central U.S. However, these two podcasters have some very out-of-the-ordinary backgrounds. Jessica studied classic literature, Dustin is a film buff with a keen eye for cinematography, and they both live and teach in Japan. Their usual interests and experiences combine with a folks next door approachability to produce a movie podcast that can get fascinatingly deep while remaining fun and easy to listen to. Whether they are dissecting story structure, discussing editing techniques, or just laughing about how Jessica becomes a giggly mess whenever something cute comes on screen, there is never a dull moment with the Poops. They don't always agree, and they don't always keep their facts straight, but they are always fun to hang out with for a few hours, and they always leave me with a better appreciation of the movies they cover.
Thank you. That's a nice review.
It is.
If you'd like to leave us a rating and review on iTunes or Stitcher, we'll read it on the show. And remember, high ratings equal exposure for our little podcast, so we really appreciate those 5 stars.
As always, you can find us on our website at popcornpoops.com. Please follow us on Twitter and like us on Facebook if you'd like to receive updates about the show, including our weekly movie still identification game. If you have a question, comment, or movie request for us, you can reach us on our social media outlets or by emailing us at thepopcornpoops@gmail.com.
Next week, we'll be wrapping up our month of bad horror movies with Luis Llosa's 1997 film, Anaconda. If you have any questions about that movie or related topics you'd like us to discuss, please contact us through social media or email.
Thanks for listening, and until next time, take care.
Bye-bye.
We are the Popcorn Poops.
Hey there, Popcorn Poop listeners. Super Hammered Bros here.
We invite you to check out our podcast, where we're a nerd discussion about geeky stuff you love.
We talk about video games, anime, movies,
and everyone else in talk related.
Here's us writing about Batman.
The Joker in this version is apparently a martial artist now.
Maybe he got beat up so a lot, and I'm going to take up and I'm going to learn this.
Yeah, he got tired of getting his ass kicked. He went to karate school to figure it out. The final fight has the Joker fight against Deadshot. The Joker and him are going toe-to-toe with each other in close quarters combat over here.
Wait, what?
It's just like, when did the Joker learn how to do this shit?
They laughed at me when I read this book, but Luke is laughing now.
The other thing was a similar thing happened with Harley Quinn. She fights Batman and she fights him off. Like, she also went to the same karate school as the Joker did.
Well,
Batman.
They probably went to the same school because, you know, they get a couple
couples discount. Yeah.
If you'd like to hear more,
go to superhammeredbros.com.
We're also on iTunes, Stitcher, and YouTube.
You can also follow us on Facebook and Twitter.
Just search for Super Hammered Bros.
Thanks for listening. We hope you'll hang out with us.